good to be back in North Carolina. I had a little trip last weekend up back up to New Jersey, and that was good too, but we were really glad to get back. We're considering North Carolina home now, and I'm enjoying my time here, and especially at this meeting. There was a piece of paper that was passed around. I hope everybody has a copy of it. What it is it's a four-step resentment sheet, and we'll get to that in a minute. But if you don't have a copy, I think they're probably somewhere around here. Now, in the weeks previous to this, we've covered the first step. It took us 5 or 6 weeks to cover the first step, and hopefully everyone understands what it means as far as Alcoholics Anonymous is concerned to be an alcoholic. The chapter We Agnostics basically lays it out. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot give up alcohol entirely, or if when drinking you have little or no control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. That's very, very simple. And if you're a drug addict or a food addict or anything like that, you can use that same defining terminology. If when you honestly want to, you can't stay away from it, and when using it you have little or no control over the amount you take, that's what turns it into alcoholism or drug addiction or whatever. And when that happens, there's a scale. And no matter how far down the scale you've gone, you'll find your experience can benefit others. Your ability to quit drinking on a non-spiritual basis will depend on the amount of control you've lost in drink, it says. And then in Chapter to Wives, there's the different type of heavy drinkers, alcoholics, going down the scale. There's very definitely a scale. And so, depending on how far down the scale you've gone, you'll find that you have less and less control as you go down that scale. I think we've all seen people in here who've gone to treatment, you know, 28-day treatment, and drank on the way home. I think, you know, how crazy, you know, when you think about that, how crazy is that? You've just spent $14,000 to figure out how to not drink and be encouraged to not drink and be taught to not drink and why you shouldn't drink, and on the way home you drink. It's nuts. That has to be a lack of sanity. And I think we've all seen chronic relapsers in these rooms. We've probably seen chronic relapsers in these rooms. You know, it's my belief for most of the chronic relapsers is they've gone down the scale to the point where simple meeting attendance is not going to be able to keep them sober. So, and a lot of times they're misunderstood. You know, in my earlier days up in New Jersey, the chronic relapser, after a certain point, was shunned. You know, they tell you stick with the winners. And so those chronic relapsers were the losers. But really what this book says, this book doesn't tell you to stick with the winners. It tells you to stick with the losers, the people who need you. You know, so once I got a hold of these principles, I started to see that Alcoholics Anonymous, at least up in my area, had changed significantly from what it was meant to be to what it was, you know, at that current time. And that's kind of a shame. So we understand the first step. In the second step, we come to believe that there's a power greater than ourselves that we can somehow get a hold of, get in touch with. This power we need, the first thing we need from this power is the ability to stay separated from alcohol or separated from the substances which we have little or no power over. That's the first thing we need. But we also need help managing our lives. Dash, that our lives have become unmanageable. Here's the thing, and very, very few people really want to admit this. When you're new, you know, it's very difficult to get to this truth. But the truth of the matter is whoever's been managing your life should be fired because they've done such a bad job with it. And the person who was managing your life was usually you.
Yeah.
So, you know, nobody likes to fire themselves. But that really is needed. Sam Shoemaker, who basically was one of Bill Wilson's spiritual advisors. Sam Shoemaker ran the Oxford Group in New York City, where Bill Wilson spun dry and got sober. Okay, he wrote a book called Life Under New Management. You know, you can find it on eBay still for a couple of bucks. And basically in that book, it lays out the step process. That's how you turn your management over to God, is basically the steps. Anybody in here, has anybody in here been told to turn it over? You know, you're screwing something up and you raise your hand and you share a bunch of stuff in the meeting and somebody goes, kid, you got to turn it over. Well, a lot of times they'll tell you to turn it over, but they won't explain how exactly to do that. I've been told to turn things over for a long time until I actually learned how you're supposed to do that. You turn things over by applying steps 3 through 12. That's how you turn something over. You practice steps and principles that go against your nature as an alcoholic and against your ego and against your incessant need to continue to run your life. You take these steps and these steps basically shift your whole perception and your whole behavior patterns to the point where, you know, you start to be able to do some things that you couldn't do before. The most important of which is to stay separated from alcohol. So, you come to believe this. In step 3, you know, we did step 3 2 weeks ago. That's basically making a decision that you're in. Okay, you know, okay, I admit I'm an alcoholic. I concede that I can't run my own life. I know that there's a power greater than myself out there because I see it working in so many people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You can see this power at work in our rooms more so than I think anywhere else on the planet. The transformational power of God is at work in these rooms. And you just can't deny it when you see it enough. So, okay, I'm willing to believe that there's a power greater than myself. You know, the next step is you're in. You know, you're in. I'll do what you guys say. I've run out of plans. You know, if I need to make a decision to turn the management of my life over to something that's going to help it run better, then that's what I need to do. And it's not an easy decision to make. The third step is not an easy decision to make. You know, we don't want to admit failure. We don't want to admit that we're doing a lousy job running our lives. None of us want to admit that. But the fact of the matter is you got to look and see what's going on, and be honest and true with yourself about that. So in step 3, we make a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. But that decision, unless it's followed by some action, won't mean anything. The great story that you hear all the time is there's three frogs sitting on a log, and two of them decide to jump into the pond. How many of them are on the log? Three, because the two frogs just decided they didn't do it. And so many times we're caught sitting on the log still. There was a couple of meetings up in my area that were 1, 2, and 3 meetings. Step 1, 2, and 3 meetings. And I went in there one time and I said, that's all you do? You just do step 1, 2, and 3? So you realize that everything is totally screwed up in your life. And that there is an answer to that big problem, and you're going to access that answer, and then you go back to your life is all screwed up. You know, it's a circle, and you never get out of that. How about we start looking at some of the steps that actually are offer a solution to that problem? You know, and it's happened before that people didn't agree with me. Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning. I think I said this last week. I'm really good friends with an aerospace engineer. He was in town this last weekend and did a little speaking down in Statesville. And I asked him one time, I go, Doug, what does launch mean? What do you think about when you think about launch? And he goes, Chris, launch means going from 0 to 300 miles an hour in a matter of feet. You know, so when you think of launch, that means if we're going to launch into a course of vigorous action, that doesn't mean, you know, like I'm going on vacation in a couple months, I'll bring a pad and pencil with me then, you know. Launch means like right then, nothing gets in the way of that. So you make your third step decision and then you start on your fourth step right away, at that moment, is really what this book is telling us. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. So the third step decision is a vital and crucial step, but it can have little permanent effect unless it's followed up by a fourth step. That's why I had problems with the 1, 2, and 3 meeting. You know, they were bringing a lot of beginners into this 1, 2, and 3. And it was 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. The book is basically saying that it's great to understand you're an alcoholic. It's really good to come to the conclusion that there's a power greater than yourself. And it's also a really good thing to make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the power of God. Apply spiritual practices in your life so that you can overcome alcoholism. But that's just a, you know, that's just the very, very beginning. You have to do some things after that. Our liquor was but a symptom. So we had to get down to the causes and conditions. One of the most revolutionary things about the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is it doesn't blame a lot of things on alcohol. It basically says our drinking was a symptom. And there's a lot of statements in this book and in the 12 and 12 that back that up. Bottles are just a symbol. My drinking is part of alcoholism. Alcoholism is my defective relationships. It's the emotional bondage of self, the terminal self-centeredness that I have, the perspective that's based on self-centeredness that I have, the worldview that's based on self-seeking and selfishness. That's really what my alcoholism is. And the drinking is a symptom of that. It's a bad symptom. It's a symptom that needs to be taken care of and gotten under control. But if it's just a symptom, you know, doctors understand this. They either treat the illness or they treat the symptoms of the illness. And if a doctor has the choice to be able to do either one, he's going to treat the illness first. Because treating the symptoms, you're leaving the underlying illness alone, and all you're doing is treating the symptoms. So the real answer is to treat the illness. And that's what we're doing as we move into step 4. It's the beginning of a treatment for alcoholism. We had to get down to causes and conditions. Causes and conditions of what? Of our alcoholism. Of our failure at life. The things that are... why we haven't been good managers of our own lives. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step 4. Bill Wilson was a businessman, kind of a failed businessman, but when he told stories or he used examples, he tried to use examples that he thought the people he was working with knew. Most of the first 100 were failed businessmen. So, he says, a business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. So he's saying we're going to take stock. We're going to take an inventory of ourselves. And we're going to see what has been working, what hasn't been working. We're going to see the causes and conditions. We're going to try to identify the causes and conditions of our inability to manage our own life. And we're going to start to take actions that are going to help us place ourselves in the atmosphere where God can remove these defects of character and take a little bit of control of the management of our lives. Ultimately, when we start working steps 10 and 11, we want to more and more allow God in to manage our lives. But in the beginning, it's a little tough. It's not something we're used to. So he says, the business inventory, we do exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure, being convinced that self, manifested in various ways, was what had defeated us. We considered its common manifestations. Remember earlier in step 3, we recognized that selfishness, self-centeredness, that is the root of our trouble. If you haven't gotten that, there's still some work to do in the first 3 steps. When I first read this book, I was in a treatment center in early 1989, and I read about the selfish person. And I thought to myself, you know, that really makes a lot of sense for my roommate, you know? Selfish bastard, you know? He took all the drawers in the dresser and keeps me awake at night, moving all around and everything. I couldn't see it for myself. You couldn't have convinced me I was selfish and self-centered, because I did what I thought were acts of selflessness. I would lend you money. I'd share my drugs. You know what I mean? I'd give you a ride into the city, you know, for court or something. I mean, I would do things like this, you know, with my best buddies Weezer and Bearman, and, you know, the guys who didn't even have any names. And so I thought, like, I was like a really loyal friend and all this. And, you know, I look back on it, it was completely insane. But it was hard for me to pin. You know, it's really hard to look in the mirror and admit all this stuff. It really is. We take this in chunks. We take this in pieces sometimes. But I understand today, absolutely every single problem in my life is caused at root. The root cause is selfishness and self-centeredness. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. Notice that it doesn't say alcohol destroys more alcoholics than anything else. It's basically saying resentment does. Bill understood the alcoholic. We are so angry at so many things. It's unbelievable. Even if that anger is below the horizon and it's not blatant, we're still really, really unhappy with a lot of people, a lot of institutions, a lot of principles, or the way the world works. We're unhappy with them. And the more alcoholic we are, the more pissed off we are at somebody. I mean, I have never met an alcoholic who couldn't tell me who they're mad at, you know? Every once in a while, somebody will come over and they'll be doing their four-step with me, and they'll have like 8 resentments on their four-step list. And I'll say, 8 resentments? That's a bad day. You know, that's not a lifetime inventory. You know, and that you have to help them see. That you have to help them understand what resentment is. When you look at the word resentment, you know, if you look at the Latin root where it came from, re means again, and sentiment means to feel. So what happens if we're angry, we re-feel that anger and re-feel that anger. That's really what resentment is. Is anger appropriate? Sometimes, of course it is. Sometimes it's absolutely unavoidable. But what happens is we grab that anger and we nestle it to our bosom and we feed it and take care of it and nurture it. And 10 years later, we're still mad at somebody for something they did. We're still looking to get even with them or something, you know? Like what they did to us. And one of the things that I heard that made so much sense to me one time in a meeting was, resentment is like drinking poison and expecting somebody else to die. You know? And it really is. We're going to be angry about it, but what it's doing is it's corroding our spiritual condition. From resentment stem all forms of spiritual disease. For we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. That's a great line. So the people who get sober and run off to the gym 8 nights a week and skip the meetings because they're doing powerlifting or something, they got the cart before the horse. The people who run off and are dealing with the mental stuff, going to counselors 7 nights a week and group therapy the other 7 nights and psychiatrists the other 7 nights, and they're missing out on meetings or 12-step processes, they've got the cart before the horse. We need to straighten out spiritually, and then we start to straighten out mentally and physically. And I've seen that time and again. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed the people, institutions, or principles with whom we are angry. This is number one. If you look at your sheet, on that sheet, at the top line should be the people, institutions, and principles. You just list that. Now, the sheet that I gave out, I want everybody to understand, I'm not a slave to certain mechanics. There are a lot of different forms. There's a lot of different ways to do it. Ultimately, what I'd like people to be able to do is just to be able to do these four steps with a big book and a piece of paper. You know, ultimately, that's the best thing. But, you know, I have done the Hazleton Guide. You know, every treatment center out there writes their own four step. There's the Joe and Charlie fours where you check stuff off. And I found that that's just not the way to do it. You know, check the boxes. This book asks you to put it down in black and white. So I don't really care how you do it. I don't care if you go across or you go up and down. What I'm interested in is that you comply with the instructions in the book. That's what's really necessary. So I don't care what it looks like. This form is something that I'm working with currently. Something may come up next week that makes a little bit more sense to me. You know, I'm open-minded with that stuff and not a slave to the actual mechanics. But they ask you to put down on paper the institutions, people, and principles with whom we were angry. So if it's your first four-step, that's going to cover a lot of ground. How many people, institutions, or principles were you angry at? You know? I'm also a believer in multiple inventories. It says in the step book, many of us go in for annual or semi-annual house cleanings. And basically what a house cleaning is, it's steps 3 through 9. You know, clean house, then help others. That lets me know that not everybody, but many AAs do multiple four steps, multiple fifth steps, annual or semi-annual, or in my case, every 4 years or so. I believe to do that is a very powerful experience. The second question we asked ourselves: why we were angry. And, you know, be brutally honest. Why were you angry? Write it down. I was angry because of. And just put it down there. Now, if there's more than one resentment, so let's say you're writing the resentment, I resent my father, okay? If there's more than one resentment, I use more than one piece of paper. But you'll see in here that you don't necessarily have to do that. Bill gave us two ways to write resentment inventory. One is to list out each resentment, and the other was to list all the resentments And there's two different examples in here, and we'll look at that. But the second question is, why were we angry? And try to be as accurate as possible. What I don't like to see is things like, well, I'm resentful of my father because he was never there. Okay, this is an example. He was he was never there. I mean, you know, he got your mother pregnant and you never saw him again the rest of your life. He was never there. No, that's not what I mean. Well, what do you mean? Well, he never went to my baseball games. Well, then write down he never went to your baseball games. Let's try to get to the truth here and not use these absolute statements. You know, he was a jerk. Well, don't write that down. Write down specifically why you resent the person. This is about discovering the truth about our stock and trade, and we should be as truthful as possible in it. Now we start to go into the third column a little bit, the seven areas of self. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, our sex relationships were hurt or threatened. So we were sore, we were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations which had been interfered with? We were usually as definite as this example. So here's column three. I want to explain column three and why we need to understand it and apply it to the four-step resentment inventory. If you're mad at somebody, something you have needs to be threatened, or something you want to get needs to be threatened, harm threatened or interfered with. I look at it like this. Instincts are protect what I have. Ambitions are the things that I don't have yet but I want to get. So if you harm, threaten, or interfere with my instincts, which is the stuff that I have, or you harm, threaten, or interfere with the things I want to get, which are my ambitions, that's what leads to me getting pissed off at you. And it's usually money, power, sex. Those are the big three. When you start messing with those, whether I have it or whether I want to get it, you rile me up. And we need to look at this. So the seven areas of self, basically, our self-esteem, this is how we feel about ourselves, our pocketbooks, that's our financial security, our ambitions, the things that we want to get, our personal relationships, our sex relationships, if these are interfered with in any way, if they're harmed, threatened, or interfered with, they cause us to be angry. So we need to list these down. Let me use as an example, a basic example, the IRS. Okay? Column number one. I'm mad at, you know, the IRS. Column number two. Why am I angry at the IRS? Because they're auditing me on Thursday. Okay? Well, now I've got to look at the seven areas of self. Is it affecting my self-esteem? Yeah, it's harming my self-esteem. It's, you know, my self-esteem is how I feel about myself, and I feel pretty crappy about myself right now because I got caught cheating on my income taxes. All right? Does it affect your pocketbook? You're damn right it affects my pocketbook. They're probably going to attach my paychecks for the next 2 years. Does it affect your ambitions? Yes, it affects my ambitions because I want to use that money. It may be the IRS's money, but I want that money. I got plans for it. You know what I mean? I don't want them taking it. They take enough. Does it affect my personal relationships? Well, it could. It could. Because if it gets out that, you know, I'm being audited and there's going to be criminal charges or something like that, you know, some of my personal relationships might be harmed. Is it gonna harm my sex relationship? Well, the wife might not be too happy about, you know, me not letting her know I was cheating on the income tax, and it absolutely could affect my intimate relationships. you go over it like this. A sentence, a short sentence for each of those that apply. If it doesn't apply, fine. Don't put it down. But if it applies, let's look at it. Because what we want to do is we want to see how we operate. We want to see emotionally how we operate with these resentments. And I'll show you why when we get to the fourth column. Now, when we look at Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, my employer, my wife, let's just look at Mr. Brown. The cause is his attentions to my wife, told my wife of his mistress, Brown may get my job at the office. Okay? Now, if you look at this, each one of these gets a different column for the seven areas of self. Sex relations and self-esteem, for the first one, sex relations, self-esteem, fear, security, self-esteem, fear. Those are what's affected in those three resentments for Mr. Brown. The greatest shirt I ever saw at an AA convention was, Mr. Brown needs his ass kicked. I love that. Okay, now let's look at how he does Mrs. Jones. Mrs. Jones, she's a nut. She snubbed me. She committed her husband for drinking. He's my friend. She's a gossip. Okay, he grouped them all together. And if you look, there's only one column for the seven areas of self. Personal relationship, self-esteem, fear. You know, I don't care how you can do it either way. But what we really want to do is we want to look at what's going on with these resentments. All right, he did the same thing with my employer and my wife. We went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. The first three columns, they're still wrong. You know what I mean? The first three columns, you're still pissed at them. There's really been not a lot of revelation here in the first three columns. To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse and then we were sore ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. You know, if you're going to be grumpy and cranky in Alcoholics Anonymous decade after decade after decade, you know, that's really your choice. There's a way out. There's an inventory process, and there's amends, and there's everything else that can get you from, you know, a cranky person to somebody who is pretty free. And it's available. And I really don't want to waste my life being mad all the time. The craziest thing was, is I was a resentment machine in my last years of drinking. You know, they talk about an amends list. I had a list of people I wanted to get even with. That was my list. And I would wake up in the morning, and this is what would happen. I would wake up, and the first thoughts to come into my mind was this. Those bastards! That's the first thing I would think of in the morning. You know? Hey, that's really setting the tone for a good day, you know? Oh. But I really thought they did it to me, you know? My life is in shambles. It can't possibly be because it's my fault. To the precise extent that we permit these resentments, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? But with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, that's what our hope is, and that's what's necessary. If you're an alcoholic, you need to maintain and grow your spiritual experience or you're in trouble. This business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. So to be free of these resentments is really one of the main purposes of the fourth and fifth and sixth and seventh and eighth and ninth step. To be free of this anger. Because if we don't get rid of this anger, we're not going to be placed in the sunlight of the Spirit where God can shine down and protect us. Keep us safe and protected. We're in the clouds. We're in the dark. We're always angry. We can't access the power that can keep us safe, protected, sound, sober, and help us recreate our lives. So we need to be free of these resentments. If we were to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. Now, period dictionaries are helpful sometimes when studying this book, because brainstorm has a whole new meaning today than it did back in 1939. Today, a brainstorm is, you get a brainstorm, it's like three or four people sit around, they come up with an idea for a better mousetrap or something. A brainstorm, if you read the definition in a 1939 or so dictionary, it means to completely lose your mind. It means punching holes in the walls and ripping the keys off of pianos and kicking the cats and busting the windows in the car. It means just completely losing your mind. Has anybody in here ever completely lost their mind that way? Let the record show all 600 people raised their hand. These tapes are going to go to my home group in New Jersey. Okay, the grouch and the brainstorm are not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. We turned our back to the list. Now, we understand the first three columns, but there needs to be a line of demarcation. This is a big separator here, okay? We've listed out who we were angry, why we were angry, and how it affected us. Now we need to look at the fourth column. But there's some work we need to do first. Here's what it says. We turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. If this list holds the key to our future, should we be paying attention to it? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Bring that up at the next discussion meeting. Let's talk about the key to the future, our four-step list. You'll see the meeting turn to fear or resentment really quick. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, because sometimes we have resentments that there's no basis for, had the power to actually kill. Who wants to be dominated? Does anybody in here want to be dominated by the people you hate? No way. How can we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. Spiritual sickness. Resentment is a spiritual sickness. Fear is a spiritual sickness. There's a lot of things that affect our spirit. And to some extent, all of us are spiritually sick in one way or another. So though we did not like their symptoms and the way they disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. Here's a prayer directive. Whenever there's a directive like this, we're supposed to pray. So what I ask my guys do is, after they've written the first three columns and they're about to do the fourth column, they need to do the resentment prayer. And the resentment prayer is basically this. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, "This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will, not mine, be done." And that's the resentment prayer. And we really should say that before we start filling out the fourth column. We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. Now, here's the instructions for the fourth column. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? So, you write a sentence on each of those that are applicable. Let's go back to the IRS example. All right, where had I been selfish, I was selfish because I wanted to hold on to my money, even though it was not my money. It was the IRS's money. Where was I dishonest? I cheated on my income taxes. That's illegal. Where was I self-seeking? I had plans for that money. I need a bass boat. Because without a bass boat, I'm not going to be happy. Where was I frightened? I was frightened that if I didn't get the bass boat, I wouldn't be happy. I was frightened if I didn't have that money, you know, I'd lose it. Okay, so that's a four-banger. When I start to look at this, when I write it out, is the IRS coming after me, or did I ask them to come after me? You know what I mean? They're just doing their job. They just want their money. And when I start to see this, this takes the wind out of my anger. When I see the truth about the resentment, it takes the wind out of my anger. I'll say that probably 3 out of 5 resentments disappear just when you inventory them. But for the other 2 out of 5, you know, the rest of the work is absolutely necessary, the amends and all that other stuff. But most of the resentments will disappear just when you start looking at, you know, why you even have them, the truth about your stock and trade. Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. So in step 4, in the fourth column, we forget what they did to us and we just look at our part. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters straight. Why were we willing to set these matters straight? Because we became willing to go to any lengths in step 3. That was part of step 3. The decision to go through the rest of the steps was part of the third step decision. You know, I've really had some resentments in my day. I'm going to finish up just telling a few of my own personal experiences with this step. I was running around with this guy. We're doing a lot of AA work. This is around 1999, and we were doing workshops and we were doing a whole bunch of stuff together and. And for one reason or another, you know, I'm sure that I played a part in this. For one reason or another, this guy kind of turned on me. And he started talking behind my back. And I found that out because people were coming up to me and saying, Chris, so-and-so, you know, was telling us to stay away from you, that you're going to get drunk. And you know, what it was actually was I shared a fifth step with this guy. And he started telling everybody all the stuff that I had shared on the fifth step. And he was saying, you know, Chris said all this stuff, and he's going to get drunk. And I confronted him. I go, hey, you know, guys are coming to me saying that you're talking crap about me. What is that? And he's like, nope, not saying anything. Nope. And, you know, I mean, this went on and on and on, and it got to the point where it really started to drive me crazy. It started to eat my lunch. I mean, this guy who's supposed to be my spiritual brother is sharing all this stuff from my fifth step. He's telling everybody to stay away from me, who are my support group. He's telling my sponsees to fire me, and he's not admitting this to my face. I was pissed. You know what I mean? And I started to gather the troops. Now, here's my part in it. What happened was I started to gather the troops. I started to get my team up against his team. You know, my half of AA against his half of AA. And this comes out of a misperception of being under attack. You know, I mean, I really misperceived. This was him acting out the way he was acting out. And I was reacting really, really poorly because I was bringing a lot of other people into it. Now, it got got to the point where I couldn't sleep. You know, some meetings I didn't feel comfortable in, and I recognize the fact I've got a lot of sponsees. I've gone through the steps a number of times. I know I need to do a step 4 through a step 9 on this guy. I know I do, but I don't want to, because I'm justified with this. You know, he did. You know, I didn't do it. He did all this stuff, and for the longest time, I held out. I held out on this. I wouldn't do what I needed to do. And finally, it became apparent that I was getting so emotionally ill that I could drink over this. You know, I could drink over this. So I bit the bullet. I did a 4-step on it. Okay? I shared it with somebody. Step 6, step 7, prayed for, you know, the willingness to have these defects of character removed, the things that made me think I was so certain that it was all this guy's fault, that I had no part in this. And then, I put the 8-step card together. And in the 8-step card, I played some role in this. I did not treat him the way I would have liked to be treated. I talked bad about this guy. I gathered troops against this guy. And I put all this stuff down on my 8-step card, and I gave him a call. And I met with him. And it was like drinking salt water. It was awful. I hated every minute of this. You know, getting in front of this guy who I really perceived hurt me so badly, was attacking me so viciously, to stand in front of this guy and to take responsibility for my part in this was not something that was fun. But it's important for me to tell you what the outcome was. I did this because people were expecting me to, you know, my sponsees. I was expecting myself to do it. It was the right thing to do. If I wanted to be saying that I'm working a 12-step program, damn it, I should be working that 12-step program and not thinking I'm above it. You know, so I got down to business and I did it, and I stood in front of this guy. And I want to tell you that when I was done and he got in his car and he left, I was free. I was free from that bondage of emotion that the guy had caused me. I couldn't care less about him anymore. I don't wish him harm. I don't care. You know, I mean, we've actually been friendly in the years since, a little bit friendly. But it's not something that preoccupies me anymore. And sometimes it's those resentments that we feel are justified that will get us drunk. Sometimes it's the resentments that build up with people in Alcoholics Anonymous that forces us out of the rooms. When you're new, you are incredibly susceptible to resentments. Because what can happen is you can just not like the people in your AA group. And you got to get yourself to some kind of spiritual safety, because sometimes that makes sense, you know. So sometimes there's some real knuckleheads in some of the meetings that I've gone to. But you don't want to be controlled or dominated by those individuals by holding a resentment against them. I almost died because of resentment in my first year. I was part of a home group for about 90 days, and then I got mad at people in the home group, and I went to another home group, and then I was with that home group for about 6 months, and then I got pissed off at that. I came there. You wouldn't believe how they're doing this and they're doing that, and so and so's in there, and oh, if I hear this guy share one more time, I'll kill myself. I gotta get out of here. You know, this is there's no recovery here. You know, and so I switched to another home group. You know, what I was doing was I was bringing the problem with me every time. The only thing I did right was get another home group when I left one. You know, at least I kept coming. But you know how many people don't do that? You know, how many people just get mad and then just give up on AA entirely? And without the help of AA, cannot overcome drinking? There's so many people that go through that. And it's sad. So I believe in what this book says. This book has some time limits in it, folks. Launch next, now, then. You know, these are the words that they use in between the steps. And I still heard things up in New Jersey like, well, you know, my sponsor told me to do a step a year. So it'll take you all year to figure out your problem. It'll take the whole second year to believe that there's a solution for it. The whole third year you'll be deciding to do something about the problem. You know? Does that make any sense to anybody? Oh. But you would hear that. So I believe in addressing these steps the way the book asks us to, with a sense of urgency. If resentments are going to destroy us, then shouldn't there be a sense of urgency about the fourth step? If nothing kills alcoholics more than resentment, shouldn't there be a sense of urgency about getting to a fourth step? So often people think that you have to get better to be able to do the steps. And they don't remember that these steps were put into place in this book for low bottom, pull them off the Bowery, they're still pissing their pants alcoholics. You know what I mean? They're homeless and they're going through the DTs and they're pulling them out of hospitals and booby hatches. You know, these steps are simple enough to be able to address rather quickly. You know, and my belief is that when we seriously want to, when we're desperate to separate from alcohol, we get a grace period. It's the grace of God. We get a grace period. And we have a period of sobriety. And for some people, that's a matter of days. For some people, it's a matter of years. But that grace lasts only as long as ignorance and inattention to spiritual detail. I think a lot of people that relapse out of Alcoholics Anonymous do so because there was no sense of urgency to move through these steps. They were basically allowed to languish in the fellowship, not being held accountable to the solution and working the solution. You know, one of the things that I deal with in my professional life is alerting treatment facilities to the efficacy of the 12-step process. They all see that observable, the people who they release, if they become really involved with a 12-step fellowship, there's a higher rate of recovery with those people. But it's very, very difficult for them to quantify it. It's very, very difficult for them to understand it because it's not scientific. A spiritual awakening is not really that scientific. It's very difficult to observe. And another thing that a lot of these treatment centers think, and they really do think this, is that attendance at AA meetings is being in AA, doing AA. Now, our statistics are awful for recovery. They're around 6-8% of the people who come through the doors of AA who are still sober 5 years later. Okay? 6-8%, maybe less. But the fact of the matter is, those statistics are based on the people who walk through the door. They're not based on who has gone through the steps. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed the path. So by allowing somebody to think they're in AA or they're doing AA because they're showing up at meetings is a real disservice to those individuals. Because your chances of just coming to AA and not drinking are about 6%. However, your chances of coming into AA and working through the 12 steps are, rarely have we seen a person fail. You know, that's the difference between night and day, black and white. That's the difference between life and death for some of us. So, again, there should be a sense of urgency. I think that this should be addressed quickly. How soon should somebody be starting on their fourth step?
Today.
Some people will say when they stop vomiting. Some people will say, you know, let them get detoxed, let them get a week or two to clear their head, let them get some treatment. You know, I'm okay with all that stuff, but remember that there's a grace period. And if you're not about the business of the steps before that grace period is over, you relapse. And that's what I've seen. And again, I hope everybody in here has done a fourth step. If you haven't, please get with somebody with some experience and do it. It'll change your life. It'll change your life. This whole program is about freedom, folks. You know, freedom from alcohol, but also freedom from the bondage of self. That's all I got tonight. Thanks.